All right, thanks everyone. Please have a seat. Good morning. We have, our first three cases are roughly related, and so is it worse for everyone? We're going to try to take those three cases and then take a recess. We'll see whether that actually works out for everyone, but that's my plan at the moment. So I'll start with the Tate case. This is SC 932. May I have the entry of appearances, please, first for the people? All right, and for the respondent, please.
Catherine Wilson, Michael Tate.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 30 minutes. This means each side has 15 minutes. Please keep track of your own time. Ms. Warble, when you're ready, please.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Warbaugh and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. After the United States Supreme Court's decision in Miller v. Alabama, the question to be resolved by this court is to craft an appropriate remedy for the approximately 50 cases of juveniles convicted as adults of first-degree murder between 1990 and 2006 and sentenced to mandatory sentences to life without parole. Looking at the Miller opinion, Miller's reach is limited to sentences to life without parole that are mandatory. Miller does not stand for the proposition that juveniles convicted of murder cannot receive sentences to life without parole, only that such sentences must be imposed based upon individualized sentencing determinations. Miller, like Graham before it, likens a sentence to life without parole for a juvenile to a sentence to death for an adult, the ultimate penalty which can be imposed but should be used only sparingly. Miller should not be read to apply to mandatory sentences to penalties other than life without parole. Looking at the preceding opinion of Graham, Graham's reach is limited to sentences to life without parole for non-homicide offenses, which it flatly outlawed. Thus, Graham does not apply to homicide offenses, nor to sentences other than life without parole. Given that Miller makes unconstitutional Colorado's statute requiring released juveniles to be given mandatory sentences to life without parole, the challenge for this court is to craft a legal sentence authorized by our statutes. Any other sentence is illegal if it is not authorized by our statutes. So after Miller, a statutory gap exists, and this court must determine what is a legal sentence for these juveniles convicted of first-degree murder.
Well, in Tate's case, did the trial judge exercise any discretion? Was there any available?
Not on the murder conviction, Your Honor. The court imposed some other sentences for other convictions. Since Miller, the Colorado legislature has met for two full terms, but has not filled the statutory cap for these cases between 1990 and 2006, nor has the governor commuted these sentences. Accordingly, it falls to this court to figure out how to fill the gap in the statutes. The Court of Appeals solution in this case is no solution at all. Even assuming a discretionary sentence to life without parole would be an appropriate and legal sentence for some of these offenders, and we have, as I said, about 50 of them, and I don't know, since the Supreme Court said that such a remedy would be applied sparingly, whether if those cases were to be reconsidered by trial courts, if perhaps half of them would be appropriate for life without parole. But at any rate, our statute is a mandatory statute, and so a discretionary sentence is not really what our statute envisions. Moreover, the Court of Appeals, in remanding this case to the trial court, makes an assumption that a life sentence would be appropriate, but then opens the gates for a chaotic free-for-all in saying that the court could then impose any sentence it liked.
But you don't read Miller and these cases to mean that at the time of the sentencing for the conviction, the court must have some discretion with regard to the sentence?
If the sentence is to be life without parole. I believe that Miller is very narrow on this point and requires this individualized sentencing for sentences to life without parole. That's because, again, this is the ultimate penalty, like death for an adult, and because they will never get a chance at the parole board, their opportunity is at sentencing to show why they would be candidates for a sentence other than life without parole.
Could you tell me just your logic, then you default instead of the position that the sentencing should be 40 years, parole after 40 years? And why is that? Why? How do you get there? Why is that your default position?
I get there looking first at the statutes. The statutes give our sentences for first-degree murder as life imprisonment or death.
Right.
So death is off the table for juveniles. So life imprisonment is the sentence. And a life sentence is permissible after Miller. In fact, a sentence to life without parole is permissible after Miller, but only after an individualized sentencing determination. But Miller has nothing to say, essentially, about the constitutionality of a sentence to life without life with parole. And I think we can safely assume that, at least at this point, such a sentence is constitutional. So again, returning to the Colorado statutes, our statutes provide for life imprisonment or death. Parole eligibility is set out lower in the statute. The statutory ranges are in 1A, and in 4A, parole eligibility is set forth, and there are three sentences. The first says that the penalty is life imprisonment unless it's death. The second says between 1985 and 1990, life imprisonment was life without the possibility of parole for 40 years. The final sentence is the one that's now been rendered unconstitutional with regard to juveniles. It says, as any person sentenced for a Class 1 felony for an act committed on or after July 1st, 1990, life imprisonment shall mean imprisonment without the possibility of parole. So that sentence, I think we all agree, is unconstitutional after Miller as applied to juveniles. If we look at the parole regulations, a separate but equal statutory scheme that is harmonized with the sentences to imprisonment, looking at subsection 2A, we can see the evolution of the Colorado legislature's thinking on this issue. Because in 2A, as set forth, before 1977, offenders sentenced to life in prison were parole eligible after 10 years. That changed then after 1977, and it was doubled to 20 years until 1985, when it was doubled again to 40 years. And if we look at that statute that was enacted in 1985, sub C, it's 2C of 17-22.5-104, that statute has no end date to it. It says on or after July 1st, 1985. So my position is that that statute can be read to apply to our juveniles sentenced between 1990 and 2006 without doing damage to other parts of the statutory system, because on its face, it can apply to an inmate imprisoned under a life sentence. It's then the following subsection, D1, which came into effect in 1990, that begins by saying no inmate imprisoned under a life sentence for Class 1 felony committed on or after July 1st, 1990 shall be eligible for parole. So that's another sentence which absolutely, as applied to juveniles, is unconstitutional after Miller. So we have these two statutes that have been rendered unconstitutional. There's a gap for this court to fill, and there are two ways to get there using these available statutes.
And that's where I'd like you to focus your attention, right?
The first is,
because you have to have some sort of internal logic to get where you're going, and that's really what I'm asking about. Is why, and maybe I improperly used the word default, but why is that where you're taking us in terms of your logic?
Well, the doctrines of severance and statutory revival are appropriate here because in doing so, this court applies the legislature's duly enacted statutes. That then respects the legislature's authority to prescribe criminal penalties, and it is, in fact, the antithesis of judicial activism because it is using the duly enacted statutes by the legislature. The simpler of the two doctrines is statutory revival, in which a statute that is found to be invalid is replaced by an earlier constitutional statute. And in this case, then, this 1985 statute can be applied to give the youthful offenders parole eligibility after 40 years. This has the added benefit that that means that, and consistent with legislative intent from both before the period 1985 to 1990 and the period after 2006 to present, that all of these juveniles will receive the same sentence, which is life with the possibility of parole after 40 years. And I think statutory revival is a principled way to approach this. And I would commend to this court's attention the Florida cases I have cited, which discuss employing this method to fill a gap. And this is, of course, a stopgap exercise, since the legislature has not.
You suggested, and I'm sorry if I'm going to dominate, but you suggested that's the second choice, since you think it's the lesser of the two choices that you're offering.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I believe I said it was the simpler choice.
The simpler, maybe.
Because we only say that the now unconstitutional statutes are replaced by the preceding model.
Go ahead.
Okay. Severability gets to the same end. It's a slightly different doctrine. The doctrine of severability is that where a statute is found to be unconstitutional, that part which is unconstitutional can be severed if it doesn't do damage to the statutory scheme as a whole. And that is the solution reached by the Court of Appeals in the Banks decision, the next case on this docket. And the people's position is that this is possible without doing damage to the statutory scheme, because we need for the statutes to still be effective for adult offenders. But in fact, if they're unconstitutional as juveniles, we need a solution for the juveniles. And that solution is found by giving them the life sentence to imprisonment, which is set forth in the sentencing statute, but by giving them the possibility of parole as set forth in the 1985 statute in the parole provisions.
When in Colorado has there ever been an example of using revival or severance when a portion of a statute is simply unconstitutional as applied?
Your Honor, I've never seen it done in Colorado. That doesn't mean that it can't be done. I have found no cases that do so. I would direct this court's attention, as I said, to the Florida courts who have done so with regard to revival, and the Massachusetts and Iowa courts who have done so with regard to severance.
And if it hasn't been done, how does it constitute the more principled way, as you put it, to resolve the problem?
Because it effectively gives us a penalty for first-degree murder that is consistent with the legislative intent, and I think that is principled. If possible, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Lord?
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. What the Attorney General is asking for is this court to rewrite the statute. I heard her say repeatedly, we need a stopgap measure. We want the court to craft a solution. Well, crafting a solution of the sort that the Attorney General is requesting is rewriting the statute, and that's something that this court has consistently refused to do. About severance and revival, I think the court appeals and Tate dispensed with that very quickly. It's correct. It's never been applied to a statute as applied. And our Title II statute that gives us our legislative intent on how to interpret our statutes doesn't talk about severing a part of the statute as applied to a class. It talks about severing, removing a part of the statute. If this court wants to sever the sentence that the Attorney General has focused on, it needs to take out life without parole for all offenders, because that's what our statute says. I understand that this court is unlikely to act in that direction, given what Miller holds, which has nothing to do with adults. But given that, we have to look to the statutes we have to see the sentencing that's available. And the life, 40-year life urged by the state is a request that the court re-raise. And I'd ask that the court not do that. Just as recently as Candelaria, this court has refused to do it. The Attorney General is correct. We're in a situation right now where Miller has rendered unconstitutional our mandatory life without parole statute for juvenile offenders. Everyone agrees. Another thing that Miller has done indirectly, and we haven't talked about too much, is undermine this court's precedent in Cisneros, Valenzuela, and the Court of Appeals precedent in Hernandez that said age is irrelevant to a proportionality analysis. And I was recently rereading Cisneros, which is from this court, 1993, and in that case, it was a 4-3 decision. And it's got a tremendous dissent by Justice Kirschbaum going through the history of proportionality review and the Supreme Court's review and our court's review. And it's really worth reading. But the point is, those cases are no longer good law. They can't be. Because at the heart of Miller and Graham and Roper...
Wait, you're suggesting that the default is a proportionality sentencing constitutional analysis? We don't have any statute that addresses this circumstance.
At a minimum, it's what the Court of Appeals held in Tate, which is a remand for the district court in the first instance to exercise its discretion and impose a proportional sentence in light of the factors set forth in Miller and Graham. I would say, as I was preparing for this argument, I was rereading Title 18, which is quite experience, but there's a statute 18.1-403 which says if a penalty is not attached to a felony, the sentence is 5 years plus 2 years of mandatory parole. I don't expect this court to adopt that as the mandatory sentence for all juveniles who've been sentenced to life without parole. The crime involved is far too serious. I understand that. But what that does is provide a statute that allows for a statutorily authorized sentence. And what one could do is what I suggested in my brief for other reasons, is look to the lesser included offenses for a legitimate sentence. For after deliberation murder, it's
less. Ms. Lord, I think those are actually very creative ideas. But I guess what concerns me, and I think actually what the AG is presenting is very creative as well. But what concerns me is how you started this argument, which is, in fact, you're asking us as a court to creatively solve this problem, to legislate. Is it not correct? Are you not maybe just asking us to do this in a different way?
I believe I'm tethering my request to principles of law that this court has long acknowledge. This court has remanded for resentencing and for courts to exercise their discretion in the Gaskins case, for example. The Court of Appeals, who more often than this court...
But isn't the difference with the Gaskins case is that there was a range of sentencing, and then Gaskins said, and it has to be proportional. But there was this given range before the proportionality analysis took place. And here, all of a sudden, we don't have that range, and we're asking the trial judges, almost without any guideline or any statutory range, to individualize their sentence.
I think that is the prudent way to go at this point. I think the Supreme Court in Illinois, and Davis cited in the reply brief, because all these cases are coming out. I mean, I could give you more supplemental authority after this argument, but it sent the case back to the trial court, who they're the experts in sentencing, for them to impose a proportional sentence in the first instance.
But proportional to what?
Proportional to youthful characteristics, the nature of the crime. There's a real requirement.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be argumentative. I'm really trying to drill down a bit. Proportional to the way juveniles were sentenced under the statute prior to the time that it was declared unconstitutional? I mean, if I were a trial judge, I might use that logic. Because I don't know what I'm comparing with, and I'd want to be apples and apples.
I think that all we have available to us right now under our statutes are the statutory ranges available for lesser offenses. And that gives district courts a great deal of discretion to consider the Miller factors, up to 48 years in most cases of first-degree murder. And it also has an attendant statutory scheme. I think the state had talked about Title 17 and parole eligibility as a co-equal statute. Well, it's different. It's not the sentencing statute in Title 18. And if you read through Title 17, another thing I did to prepare for this argument, you get statute after statute after statute talking about parole for F2s, F3s, F4s, F5s. And there's nothing in there that would apply to this group of individuals. I attached the 2006 House bill to my brief so that this court could see how much the legislature actually had to do to convert life without parole to 40-year life for juveniles. And I'd just like to take a step back, too, and aside from there being no statutory support, and the whole thing about statutory construction is to implement the legislature's intent. And the state has said the legislature's intent is to hammer juveniles as hard as possible. And there's no indication in Colorado's history of that. You know, decades before Roe was decided, the Colorado legislature had taken death off the table for juveniales. In 2006, before Graham was decided, before Miller was decided, the legislature took life without parole off the table for juveniales. When we look to our legislative intent and the guideposts for interpreting what our statutes mean, go to Title II, see what severance is about. Go to the case law interpreting Title II, and what you see again and again. Severance means eradicate, you take it off. The state is asking you to apply to sever one sentence, a very critical sentence of a statute that defines what life's meant for a particular group of people. And they're also asking you to apply one part of Title VII and then the other part of Title VII. And the part that they're asking you to apply really applies to habitual offenders. And it's really clear in terms of the legislative intent and the legislative history. It applies to people who are sentenced to life for a crime, not to people who are sentenced to life for a Class 1 felony conviction. For that, all offenders must receive life without parole in this time frame. And that, the one thing we don't disagree on is that that cannot be done. I think it is an exercise of judicial discretion that you remand in the first instance. The court may want to give some guidance. The court may want to see what happens in the district courts first. In Mr. Tate's case, we have a specific jury finding that Mr. Tate did not kill, did not intend to kill, did not cause death, did not cause serious bodily injury. In Mr. Tate's case, it's very probable that his case is more covered by Graham. But what the Court of Appeals did in Mr. Tate's case is said, we're not going to reach the issue of whether in his case, life without parole would be categorically prohibited, because we don't know what the district court, what sentence the district court is going to impose. And absent that, we would be reaching issues that we do not need to reach. I think even the state, I was looking at their brief in Mr. Banks' case, and the state said, if you don't accept our 40-year life, our mandatory one-size-fits-all juvenile offender's 40-year life sentence, then the constitutionality of 40-year life really isn't before the court. And the state, aside from its outreach, which was wholly accepted in Banks, and in a way that is inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence, you know, it may have a surface appeal of...
Well, let me say, though, that's about the closest we can get to their intent, that 40 years, you know, of imprisonment is in the ballpark. And I'm sorry for using that wording. So why isn't that a starting place for a proportionate sentencing in the trial court?
It could definitely be a reference for proportionate sentencing, but I'll tell you, the legislative intent in 2006 was not informed by Miller or by Graham, and by the profound change that has occurred in the past 16 years. People here, people there, a lot of people prosecuted in the 90s, a lot of people judged in the 90s, a lot of people defended in the 90s, and at that time, people were truly oppressive in the sentencing of juveniles. The juveniles committed very serious crimes, and they were treated very
well. There's an explanation for that. We have suffered in the community gang violence among youth, and the crisis in 1993 and all that certainly fixed the legislative intent on that problem.
Absolutely. Bullets were going across my front porch in Park Hill, and I understand that. But what Miller and what Graham say is children are really different, and sometimes the crimes, awful as they are, overwhelm the notion that children are different, and we constitutionally cannot judge at the outset that these youths should spend the rest of their lives in prison with no hope for release.
Counsel, can I redirect you? This goes back to the Chief's questions. I'm not sure I fully understand your response. Whether we call it severance or we call it simply unconstitutional as applied, and we move in your direction on a remand, I'm still struggling to understand by what statutory authority the trial court is left with to impose a sentence, period, in this case. Now, we understand from the law that life without parole is permissible so long as requisite findings in youth is taken into account, so that's an option. But what is the statutory authorization for something less than that, other than 18.403 without a provision? I mean, that looks like the options that are left.
Well, you have jury verdicts that find every element of a lesser offense.
And I'm sorry to take you outside of Mr. Tate's case, but what if that's not the case in some other juvenile setting? If there's not a conviction on a lesser included or evidence to support a lesser included?
It will always be the case for a Class 1 felon.
Okay.
It really will. And the thing is, if you are going to rewrite the statute, because that's all that the 40-year life is, there is no, it may be theoretically, and I'm not conceding this and I don't have enough time to go into why, it may theoretically comply with Miller after individualized sentencing 40-year life, but it has no foundation in our statute. If you're going to rewrite the statutes, let's have 10-year life, let's have 20-year life, let's have 30-year life, let's animate the principles that were set forth by the Supreme Court that may go against our common judgment, but they have said that these children must be given a meaningful opportunity of release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. And that doesn't mean waiting until they're on death's bed to give them an opportunity of parole.
May I just follow up with a quick question? So you're proposing you have 16 to 48 mandatory 5 years parole off of, okay, I just want to be clear about the range that you're contemplating.
Yes, that's one, that's justified by statute. And I think prosecutors would be more than willing to go with that because of the alternate of 5 years when there's no penalty attached to a felony, which is what we have as applied now to juveniles. And defense lawyers wouldn't be able to say, no, that's not permissible because of the jury verdicts that have found each and every element that would justify that very serious sentencing. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Roper. Ms. Roper.
In my review of many of the out-of-state authorities, in courts that have remanded to the trial court, they seem to remand to the trial court in order to decide whether to impose a sentence of life without parole or life with parole. And I cited a Texas case for this proposition. There's also a recent Pennsylvania Supreme Court case cited by the defense. And so what the solution proposed by the people does is it takes life without parole off the table for all these offenders. I think Ms. Lord has agreed that giving a 5-year sentence is not an appropriate sentence for murder, And I don't think it's a fair solution, nor is it necessary for this court to look to the F2 range. It's not necessary because this court can craft a sentence for a class 1 felony, which is what these juveniles were convicted of. And we have direction from our statutes saying a life sentence is appropriate, and we can also add in life with the possibility of parole after 40 years. So this crafts a response that is consistent with our legislature and also is appropriate for a class 1 felony, as opposed to merely treating all these individuals as if they were in fact only convicted of class 2 felonies. I would also dispute Ms. Lord's statement that these individuals will be ready for parole on their deathbed. All of these individuals are going to be ready for parole in their late 50s. And as someone looking at her 52nd birthday, I'm looking forward to many decades of useful life ahead of me. And I would reject the idea that this would be on the defendant's deathbed that they would be parole eligible.
What's individualized about your, you said there has to be individualization that occurs at the sentencing hearing post-Miller, but how does your approach constitute any individualization?
No, Your Honor, my position is that to impose the ultimate sentence of life without parole, individualized sentencing is necessary. It's not necessary to impose any other sentence or any other mandatory sentence, only mandatory life without parole.
Thank you very much. Your time is up.